Hello, welcome to November's APTA Neurosection Vestibular SIGS podcast on vestibulopathy. My name is Ethan Hood. I'm a physical therapist. I'm the assistant director of the St. Luke's Warren Balance Center and St. Luke's Warren Concussion Center in Philister, New Jersey. We have three additional members on a very distinguished panel today. We have Wendy Webb Schoenwald, who's a physical therapist and the owner of WWS Physical Therapy and Vestibular Rehab. She practices in Doylestown, Pennsylvania, which is just outside Philadelphia. She's an orthopedic clinical specialist, and her practice is also focused on vestibular rehab and concussion management. She's also been lecturing for many years to local colleges in the area, and also lectures with their Herdman Vestibular Certification course. Her practice is also involved in a clinical trial with Temple University on the treatment of lateral canal BPPV. So welcome, Wendy.
Thank you, Ethan.
We have James Barsky, and Jim Barsky is the lead vestibular therapist at Chestnut Hill Hospital, which is a hospital right outside Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. He's also the CEO of Neurology, Psychiatry, and Balance Therapy Center, which he opened a little over a year ago, which he's very excited about opening. So welcome, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And we have Wendy Kriegels, who's also a physical therapist, and she's a senior instructor at the University of Colorado Denver Physical Therapy Program, and she also works in the clinic with a special interest in balance and vestibular disorders. So thanks for being here, Wendy.
Thank you.
Okay. So our topic is vestibulopathy. And vestibulopathy, and we're going to get into it a little more, is really kind of a junk term that is used when we see it on a prescription from a physician. So I know, Wendy, you want to answer this first, but what exactly is vestibulopathy?
Right. So when I hear the term vestibulopathy, it's really meant to be a general term, usually referring to the peripheral end organ, so the vestibular system. Otoliths, semicircular canals. In my experience, it's also been used to refer to the vestibular portion of cranial nerve 8. So it really, the term in and of itself just tells you it's probably more of peripheral origin, and it really raises more questions about, well, which piece of the vestibular end organ is impaired in this particular case.
Okay. So, Wendy Schoenwald, when you see this on the prescription, what usually is the cause, or what actually usually is the actual diagnosis?
Well, generally, a lot of the physicians aren't really sure what's wrong with the patient when we get that diagnosis. It could be a unilateral hypofunction, neuronitis, labyrinthitis, and sometimes even they lump BPPV into that diagnosis.
Jim, do you see the same thing as well?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of times they're not too sure exactly what they have. It will often be used for like the vestibular neuritis or labyrinthitis, though, but they'll just use that term vestibulopathy or some of the other terms too.
Yeah, that's usually what I see in practice as well. Usually they mean neuronitis or labyrinthitis, but also it can mean BPPV. It can actually mean Meniere's. Essentially what it really means is that something's not right with the peripheral vestibular system. So it's kind of up to us during our evaluation to figure out what exactly is going on when we see that on the prescription. Now what exactly is, when we're talking about like neuronitis and labyrinthitis, does anyone know what the incidence or epidemiologically how many numbers in the population are affected each year?
Well, I think doing a little bit of research, and I've seen ranges of about like 7% of the patients presenting to outpatient clinics that specialize in treating people with dizziness. That's about the range that I've seen. I've also seen a number of 3.5 per 100,000 people as a number too, and affecting mostly people between 30 and 60 years old, with a peak for women in the fourth decade or men for the sixth decade.
Okay. So essentially when you're talking about vestibulopathy, inner ear disorders are quite common, actually. And I guess that's why we're all in business, because we all have specialty balance centers, essentially. Now, in terms of vestibulopathy, and this goes to Wendy Schoenwald, when you're talking about neuronitis or neuritis and labyrinthitis, is there a difference, and what exactly is the difference then?
So yes, and during our evaluation, we are trying to figure out this. So neuronitis is damage to the sensory nerves of the vestibular ganglion. Neuronitis is inflammation of the vestibular portion of that eighth cranial nerve. Okay. Labyrinthitis refers to damage to both branches of the ACE nerve, and we generally differentiate that by the hearing loss that's associated with that.
Okay.
I think clinically we tend to use the term hypofunction or unilateral vestibular loss, just indicating that there's some kind of imbalance functionally that in the clinic we're going to address.
Okay. So Wendy Krekels, from a pathophysiological perspective, what exactly happens with vestibulopathy? What's causing that damage to the nerve?
Well, we've talked about a lot of terms here. So if we keep with the large umbrella of vestibulopathy, mm-hmm. each of these types of vestibulopathies are going to have a different mechanism, of course.
Okay.
So if we talk about a viral or a bacterial source, that's when we're usually thinking about labyrinthitis, neuronitis, and it usually goes along with systemic illness, perhaps flu-like illness, fever, that sort of thing. That also will cause some vestibular symptoms for reasons I don't know that are exactly clear.
Okay.
When we're talking about other types of vestibular pathology, which I don't think we're going to do necessarily in the scope of this particular podcast, but certainly Meniere's disease is a vestibulopathy with its very own mechanism, you know, acoustic neuroma, same thing, paralymph fistula, all of that. So if we want to just kind of narrow this discussion from vestibulopathy in general down to neuronitis and labyrinthitis, I think it's a really nice model to discuss how we as physical therapists will treat it. And like Wendy said, it really is worth thinking about a hypofunction, and we want to uptrain to the best ability that we can.
No, I agree with you. I agree with just kind of limiting it to neuronitis or labyrinthitis mm-hmm. As well. Now, Jim, as far as some of the symptoms that a patient's going to come in with, either neuronitis or labyrinthitis, what are some of the symptoms that the patient's going to bring into the clinic? What are they going to be complaining of?
Yeah, well, very acutely, they can have very severe vertigo, nausea, vomiting, and being off balance at disequilibrium. This can last for up to a day to several days. Once they start to stabilize, feel better, and there's some adaptation within the brain, then they may feel this more just with certain movements or within certain environments. But it's usually a fairly sudden onset with strong vertiginous symptoms lasting for a day to several days initially. And then it can change from there depending on progression and how well the patient's managed early on.
Okay. So as far as between neuritis or neuronitis and labyrinthitis, the main symptom to differentiate them essentially is if there's any auditory symptoms as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's how we know it typically in the field we would differentiate them. If there's a hearing component, like a loss, strong ringing, roaring in the ears with the same type of presentation of the dizziness, yeah, which refer that as a labyrinthitis, either affecting the whole nerve or possibly the labyrinth itself. Without the hearing the symptoms, just the dizziness and the nausea and vomiting, and then we would typically refer that as like the vestibular neuritis or neuronitis.
Okay. Now, as far as we talked to Wendy Shuttle, I'm going to ask you this because we talked a little bit about mentioning it as a hypofunction, which, you know, if you look at it from a neurological perspective, it means that the firing rate of the eighth cranial nerve will decrease with the damage from neuronitis or labyrinthitis. But there's some debate on what about having an irritative lesion as well. Can you talk about what exactly an irritative lesion is?
When I think of an irritative lesion, I often refer back to Meniere's, which again we discussed. And you know, my perception of what's happening is there becomes a hypersensitivity on the involved side, on the Meniere's side, mm-hmm. and this can be quantified with VNG or caloric testing, and sequential ENGs can show an increase or a decrease in that. But I think of it as a hyper-reactive side versus when we think of labyrinthitis or neuronitis, we think of a decrease, a loss of sensitivity on that side. So, I mean, it continues to create that chronic type imbalance that patients have develop because the imbalance between the right and the left ear.
Okay. So when it crinkles, do you see the same thing as well when you're talking about an irritative lesion?
Yeah, you know, the physicians that I work with really don't use the term irritative lesion, and they usually don't refer as much. I think physical therapists are very good at focusing on the symptoms for the individual patient. Once my physicians say, you know, this is either there's a medical term for it or not, they will refer either way, which in a way is nice, but they usually don't discuss that term. Right. Maybe it's geography,
that,
you know?
Term mostly comes from the audiology, from the V&G reports. I mean, that's usually who I hear it from.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of practice, though, and in terms of actually being in the clinic, does it really change the type of treatment that you're actually doing when you say someone actually has an irritative lesion versus a hypofunction?
Personally, I think that it just may be that I would expect that patient to move slower than somebody else, because if they are more hypersensitive or their symptoms are fluctuating, I'm not going to expect them to react as classically as a labyrinthitis that's naturally healing and should get better over the next 2 to 4 weeks. An irritative lesion, I might expect that to take a little bit longer.
Okay. Jim, now as far as we have the patient coming in to the clinic and they're diagnosed with either neuritis or labyrinthitis, are there any special tests that we're going to do or any special questionnaires that we're going to do as a vestibular therapist that's going to differentiate it from a basic neuro exam?
Yeah, so in addition to doing like the standard screens, I do specific tests looking at the function of the vestibular ocular reflex. So primarily looking at the head impulse test. Other ones that I'll do just actually looking for patterns of nystagmus under infrared goggles or Frenzel lenses, which can indicate the location of the side affected and whether or not it's a central or peripheral problem. I'll do a head shake test also, and then might if to help with the diagnosis. If I'm still not sure, I'll do a dynamic visual acuity test. Again, another test of the vestibular ocular reflex. As far as questionnaires, there's a dizziness handicap inventory, looking at how their dizziness is affecting their lives, and also, these patients often have problems with balance. I'll look at, they'll use the activity-specific balance confidence scale or ABC scale, looking at how balance affects them. Also, wanted to just briefly add here, when these patients come in the acute setting, and they're trying to rule out, is this a central problem or is this a peripheral problem? Standing testing protocol that I go through and do, in addition to the regular screens, is I do a head impulse test. I evaluate the nystagmus and also look for a test of skew, where studies have shown that if patients have a positive head impulse test, they have a pattern of nystagmus consistent with a peripheral problem, and they do not have a skew deviation, that is mostly consistent with a peripheral problem. So we're talking about the vestibular neuritis or labyrinthitis. If any of one of those tests are more consistent with a central problem, then it's more likely to be a stroke or a central problem.
Okay. Wendy or Wen, did you have any additional special tests or any additional questionnaires that you find useful?
I think that what I want to, emphasize is that the Frenzel's lenses are very helpful in differentiating the labyrinthitis, neuritis from someone who doesn't have those to be available, because often we can see some nystagmus without room light that we don't see in our room light oculomotor exam. And I guess the other thing that we do are balance exam tests, the sensory integration tests. I usually use the FUCADA functional gait assessment if they are more able, and maybe a Berg if I'm looking more at static ability for balance.
Right, and I would add Jim, you mentioned the dizziness handicap inventory. I'm not sure if you mentioned the activities of balance confidence scale, but I really like that one as more of a larger measure of participation and really teasing out how much of their symptoms is true dizziness, because we really have a two-tiered approach in assessing and intervening, the dizziness component and then also the balance component. So that ABC is one that I like as well.
Absolutely.
And then the only other things I would add is just what really remains in our regular vestibular testing sort of bag of assessments. We would certainly look at saccadic eye movement and visual tracking, all that kind of thing. And I think one of the keys is really to have the individual rate their dizziness. I tend to use a scale of 0 to 10, but really to get at how sort of flared up are their symptoms, how severe are their symptoms, and with education and with their home program, we should see that gradually start to decline so that their symptoms are more manageable. So that rating, that patient rating, I think is really important.
Okay. So as far as someone comes in with neuronitis or labyrinthitis, when should vestibular therapy should be started? Should be started immediately after their onset of symptoms, or should we wait for a week or two to see if the symptoms are going to spontaneously resolve? Wendy Krykels, when should we start vestibular therapy?
Well, usually these individuals are feeling too miserable right at the get-go. I usually don't see them until they're 6 to 8 weeks out, sometimes even 10 to 12 weeks out, and they just haven't been able to come back down to a normal baseline. So oftentimes they'll come to me, it's the people who don't automatically get better. It's the people who seek their physician on follow-up and they're still having problems and then they come to me. So I don't know if Jim and Wendy, you have different practice setups, but I tend to see the people who don't just spontaneously resolve. So it's usually that 2 to 3 months post-initial infection.
I'm in private practice and we deal with a lot of direct referrals from primary care physicians who often are trying to avoid those emergency room visits. So they frequently will send patients like within the first week or two when they're up and they're mobile again. They're obviously not where they are at 6 weeks, but often we see them initially, educate them, and explain to them how they can start out with VOR times one, simple exercises and how to control their symptoms so that they can kind of keep moving and get back to work. I mean, this can be, as we know, a very disabling thing, and people just don't understand that they might have to miss work for a while. So they want to get back as soon as they can.
Jim, do you see anything different in your practice?
Yes, a little bit, but more so much with when he was just referring to. I like to see these patients immediately, even when their symptoms are so bad they can not even open their eyes. Now, I'm not doing any adaptation exercises with them at that point, but I think the education piece is so important because this is a condition that's very mystifying even to the healthcare practitioners that are seeing the patient within the hospital, and I think it's important for us to be there to, number one, just educate the patient, tell them what is going on and what they can expect as far as their recovery, and I think that goes a long way to preventing the patients from a more prolonged course where they end up with chronic subjective dizziness and other problems in the future. Once they can get to the point where they can start to open their eyes and sit up and stand up a little bit, I think educating them and also starting with activity, getting them to move around more, which has been shown to be beneficial, not to where they're overdoing, again, educating them on proper dosing where they're not making themselves too sick, but where they can move to within their tolerances, and telling them it's better to be upright and in some light versus just closing your eyes and being in bed all day.
Mm-hmm.
And then once they can start to move around, move the head a little bit, and then starting really gently with some of the vestibular adaptation exercises.
So you're talking to actually, you've seen those people in acute.
Yeah,
definitely.
In the emergency room sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, so actually you're helping facilitate the discharge process by explaining to them what's going on, and then maybe just using some substitution techniques, to kind of have their visual system override their vestibular system to give them better postural stability so they can walk to the bathroom and they can walk around their environment. Is that what you're kind of getting at a little bit?
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So when they can walk around, tell them focus on the point at the end of the hallway. Don't turn too quickly because they may say, oh, I feel good as I'm walking. And then they turn quickly, and then they go, oh, it's coming back again. Well, it's not coming back. They just didn't realize that the speed of movement can affect their symptoms. So that's going along with getting to move, and also educating them as they're going along so they know what to expect. That helps it calm their emotions, their anxiety, which then can prevent a prolonged course of this disease.
Okay.
The other thing that I also try to educate them about is often BPPV is something that follows one of these events.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to them, when they get another episode, like say they're 6 weeks out and they're feeling better and they get an event of BPPV, they think, oh, this is starting all over again.
Mm-hmm.
But, try to educate them that this can be something that occurs and that, if they need our services, that's something that's addressed differently than neuronitis.
Okay. Well, Wendy Kay, so let's say we have a patient with neuronitis, and they're 2, 3, 4, or 5 weeks out from the initial onset, and we see them in outpatient physical therapy, and we evaluate them, and they definitely have a hypofunction. What are some of the basic exercises that we're going to prescribe to improve the hypofunction?
Right. Well, basically, we address all tiers of what's symptomatic for the patient. So if they have provocation of their symptoms with head movement, eye movement, we try to get them to move gradually, starting with slow movements, to moving with a little bit faster movements. And again, having the patient rate and pace the exercise and take frequent breaks. I usually have patients do, I really emphasize home program because I think you need multiple repetitions, but they really need to understand how to pace their symptoms so they don't flare themselves and then try to get in the car and drive, for instance. So lots of patient education. As you guys have I think it's a luxury. I'm so happy to hear that you're in the emergency department. That's not where I'm practicing. I see these people once it's starting to merge onto becoming a chronic issue. So I love that you guys are in the forefront. I think it's so important for PTs. But for me, it's usually their return to work. They're returning to driving, but things are just not right yet. So really lots of patient education, home exercise program, head movements, eye movements, balance activities. I like doing like a CTSIB and seeing how they do, see if I can up-train more that vestibular use for balance. I also find that these individuals, like you guys do initially, they still need later on in sort of what settles them. So if they're in a busy parking lot, they absolutely need to be using gaze stabilization, just focus, maybe stop if they need to look around their surroundings and not try to turn their head and walk at the same time, that kind of thing. So just really substituting and paring down the activity. But then when it's safe in their own home, that they're pushing the envelope a little bit. So that's both with head and eye movements and with balance training.
Wendy Schoenwald, do you stick to specific exercises in particular?
Yes, I definitely use the vestibular adaptation exercises, VOR1, VOR2. Generally, in terms of movement and position, we start out pretty statically, so they might be doing those exercises standing with a narrow base of support or on a piece of foam, and then working into walking and trying to move their head, and also then maybe working into more rotational movements that are functional, maybe diagonal type patterns, because as Jim said, they think they're fine if they keep their head still and they make these quick movements and they feel like symptoms come back. And I too, I'm usually seeing these patients maybe one time a week with an emphasis on little bits often with their home exercises. Spend a couple minutes here, not overloading their system, and just kind of reminding it all day long with little bouts of exercise how to up-train.
Mm-hmm. How long do you usually see them for? What's the average time course if you see them once?
I would say, depending on the severity of the patient when they come in, sometime between 3 and 6 weeks. But most patients are better in 6 weeks.
Okay.
And I think what Wendy said is true. If we can see them earlier and give them that strong course of reassurance and exercise and awareness of the problem, that they tend to not develop into these more chronic patients.
Okay. I know in my practice that if someone presents with labyrinthitis neuronitis and they scored a high fall risk on one of the or any of the balance assessments I use, whether it's a functional gait assessment, dynamic gait index, I will start seeing them twice a week until their balance improves.
That's
and then
true.
I will,
yes.
And I'll decrease them to once a week. And usually anywhere from about 3 to 6 weeks, they're more than likely going to be better by that time. And as Wendy Krakel said before, the home program is paramount. If they don't do the home exercises, they are not going to get better nearly as quick. Jim, do you do any additional exercises as well?
No, I agree with everything everybody said, and that pretty much covers it. Using the vestibular adaptation exercises, if there are particular either self motions or visual motions that give them trouble, I may include a little bit of habituation exercise in that, and it's definitely the balance, even if they're not having too much trouble with balance in general, but just to try to get them to utilize their vestibular system, just with moving around in their environment, maybe a general walking program and telling again, educating the current activity, but now that's pretty much all the same things that I do too.
Okay.
So the other thing that I'd like to mention, Ethan, is I find a lot of patients, if they're seen in the ER or they're seen in the primary care office, they're given Anavert or Valium or Ativan, whichever, some kind of a neurorelaxant. And often the patients tend to stay with this for extended periods of time. And when they get to us, that's one of the first things I'm trying to stop them using because it does delay their ability to adapt with the exercises that we give them. So I try to make sure that I always look at what meds they've been given along mm-hmm. that line. Now, I mean, sometimes in the acute phases they're given prednisone or antiviral drugs or antibiotics for whatever, the doctor mm-hmm. thinks is going on acutely, and that's different than the Anavert. Mm-hmm. Or meclizine.
So you're trying to get them off the meclizine as quickly as possible then?
Exactly.
Okay.
And I just need to add this other Wendy here that anecdotally, my population who are kind of on that verge of becoming more chronic, almost all of them are still taking those medications persistently.
Wow.
And it just begs the question, if we had more upfront care and education, a lot of them just think, This is my course in life now. This is just it. And I think you make a valuable point that is absolutely one of the first things I address. And I usually need to bring in the physician, too. I say, well, did the physician tell you you're going to need to stay on this now for the rest of your life? And they say, well, no, they said I could wean off of it as I wanted to, but I've been afraid to. So, again, a lot of education because they're still having some symptoms. But they're not going to recover fully if they're constantly under a vestibular suppressant either. So that's often one of the starting points with my population is absolutely weaning them from those medications.
Great point.
Yeah, if I could comment quickly on that because, this is absolutely imperative, and I agree wholeheartedly with what everybody is saying, and that's something that I have a little bit of advantage being in the acute care and environment is that I do try to educate the physicians on this because, they're not specialists. Even, some of the neurologists, ENTs, they're not specialists either, and they just are unaware. I tell them, yes, these patients, they do need antivert or meclizine, when they're stuck in bed and they can't open their eyes, but only for this first day or two. Once they can start getting up and moving around a little bit, that's when they should be taken off of it because it will prolong the recovery. So I try to educate the patient on that. I try to educate the physicians so they don't end up, because I do see patients now, 6 to 8 weeks later, they're still popping that and the medication is not making any difference. And I just wish that they had stopped it earlier on to allow that the brain to not be suppressed so it can actually adapt to the vestibular tone imbalance that's there.
And I think, too, that the physicians in the primary care that I am in and out of their offices all the time, they appreciate the education that we can provide them because they use it and they think they're only using it for that beginning phase.
Yeah.
I don't think they're always processing that they keep renewing these prescriptions because sometimes it's done through automated systems, too. But educating them that it's not necessary to be used long-term is key.
Right, and I just want to say one more thing from the patient's perspective that I see is they don't necessarily know the difference between a more curative medication, like if they do have a course of antibiotics or steroids, versus a symptomatic medication. And a lot of times it's freeing for the patient to say, oh, you mean that meclizine isn't going to cure the problem? It's only there if I absolutely need it. And that usually is a really nice breakthrough, I think,
absolutely,
in my patient population.
Okay. Wendy Schoenwald, this is the last question here. We'll all interject with this as well. Can vestibulopathy return again? Can the person decompensate? Or I should say, with neuronitis and labyrinthitis?
I definitely see that happening again, and I do educate them on discharge about this, because when I usually feel that they're ready for discharge, I ask them to continue to do the exercises for a period of time until they have no symptoms with them and they feel that they're functioning fine. But often when they've gotten a flu or a cold or some other kind of event that kind of keeps them low or in bed for a couple of days, especially our elderly persons, they can decompensate. And I think in that situation, we have a reason for it because they're just inactive and their system automatically goes back to this imbalance or this laziness. But I think there's decompensation, too, that we don't always understand why. Mm-hmm. But generally, in those patients, if we facilitate them to begin their exercises again and challenge their system, they generally recover nicely. And then the other thing, I always try to educate them about the course of BPPV that can follow, too, mm-hmm. And how they can differentiate between that versus their labyrinthitis, because the labyrinthitis acutely, as you know, is a constant level of vertigo, whereas the BPPV is going to be a brief mm-hmm. vestibular event that should calm down. I don't think the patients always know the difference between that, because once they've had a neuronitis, they automatically think that's what's happening again.
Jim, do you have anything to add?
Just a little bit. I believe that vestibular neuritis is one of those things that probably doesn't happen again often. I've seen studies ranging between 1 and 20% of recurrence rate, mm-hmm. But it can happen. I think it's less likely early on, within like the first year or so after it occurring, because the damage is still there in the peripheral system and the brain is adapted. But then, if there's something that happens, to the brain itself, or if there's a cognitive piece or even like a behavioral emotional piece that can decompensate centrally, then you can have a reoccurrence of the symptoms.
Wendy Kriegels, do you have anything to add?
Yeah, I would just add, Jim has made the point towards general activity, which I think is great. And then Wendy talking about, especially if they're elderly, they have other things going on and they can decompensate very quickly. I think it's so important to get these people back up. If they are having whatever the symptomatology is, having them not be so afraid of general activity. So even if they need to use gaze stabilization, but they're able to walk up and down a hallway and just start to get themselves active again, they do themselves such a disservice by resting and hoping it'll go away. And I think that point of patient education is just really crucial in getting them up and showing them that, there are things that may aggravate your symptoms, but there's a whole lot you can do that's not aggravating your symptoms, and you need to be active. So,
okay, great. All right, well, that was great viewpoints. I'd like to thank Wendy, Jim, and Wendy Kriegels. Thank you very much for participating in the November's Vestibular SIGS Vestibulopathy podcast. I can't speak today.